And hello, Sense House listeners. This is Andy Bomick, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to start a brand new novel, which is so exciting, titled The Family Under the Bridge. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Malola's Museum Adventures, Career Day. And then it's Pebbles to the Sea, Dirt Cheap, Courageous Lucy, The Girl Who Liked to Worry. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with Secret Pizza Party. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled Malola's Museum Adventures, Career Day. Loved the art museum. It was her favorite place to go. She always ran through the big new exhibitions until she found her favorite room at the very back. It was her own little corner of the world, a place where she could talk about how her day had been, or what new toys she had got, or sometimes even belt out her favorite song. Paintings are, after all, the best listeners. One day at school, Malola's teacher set them a task. Today, I'd like you to write about one thing you would like to be when you grow up and present it to the class tomorrow. Malola looked at her friends all scribbling away. Confused, she thought to herself, "What if there's more than one thing I want to be, or even more things I don't know about yet?" As soon as she finished school, she ran to her favorite place. Maybe she could find some help there. She sat and gazed up at a portrait of a woman who always reminded her of her Nana. Heaving a big sigh, she asked, "What will I be when I grow up?" To her surprise, the painting responded, "My name is Safiya Jamak Gare. You've shared many things with us paintings over the years. Maybe I could share some of our world with you. Let me show you all the things you could be." With her eyes wide in shock, Malola looked up into Safiya's familiar face and followed her into the painting. Through the world of thick paint and bright brush strokes, Safiya led her towards a gentle-looking woman, confidently giving a talk to thousands. "Didn't you love leading songs at the school assembly? What if you led a nation like Shawok Zebi, the first female president of Ethiopia?" She could get used to being the center of attention, and maybe if she were a leader like the president, she could use her power to serve the people and make the world a better place. Safiya led her to the next frame. "Or maybe you can lead in the classroom, like Professor Mamoki Fanking. She's an advocate dedicated to making education more accessible. I do love school. It would be so great to share that job with even more kids like me." Safiya led her to another frame, busy with cars speeding past. "Remember when you stood up to those bullies at school? You were so confident and bold, just like Edna Naidar, a brave and fearless taxi driver. Despite being turned away for being a woman, Edna created her own taxi company and now encourages more women to challenge the idea of jobs meant only for men." Malola remembered what it was like to stand up to others who told her she could not do something. It did feel good to show them she was capable of anything they were. Plus, driving to lots of new places would be so interesting. Drive and see Chobe National Park, or the butterflies of Central African Republic, or stop by the Grand Bassam Beach. You spend so much time questioning everything. What about using your curiosity to be like Rebecca Enochong? She's now a tech whiz, but she used to stay up all night taking computers apart to know exactly how they functioned inside. Did you know Rebecca is also dedicated to helping young tech whizzes start their own companies? Or you could be like Bharatang Maya. Her curiosity led her to teaching herself how to code. She now teaches other girls just like you. Malola did love being on the computer. She imagined the symbols flowing around her, teaching her their language. Will you stand up for what you are passionate about, like Nima Namandu? She fights for the rights of women and disabled people. Her work planted a seed in her village that empowers and educates the women in her community. I want to help others, Malola said. She loved the idea of standing up for her community and of being part of something bigger than herself. I have seen you drawing many times at the museum. Perhaps you could use your creativity to express yourself visually, like Dina Akenj. She creates images using a hammer and nails. It takes real skill to build a delicate image from such strong materials. Malola did enjoy using her hands and capturing in real life the many visions that danced through her head. Why not express yourself through writing, like Ellen Banda Aku? She's written many children's books and novels, and she encourages children to express themselves through literature. The library was Malola's favorite place, second only to the museum, of course. All those experiments you do in the garden take a lot of perseverance. You may find you have this in common with Chido Governa. She learned how to farm mushrooms and teaches people all around the world. She did love nurturing all of her plants in the garden. Malola, whatever you choose to do, remember, we are always growing, and with growth comes change. So whatever you choose, know that you can always re-choose again and again. I knew I'd get answers here, she thought to herself as she waved goodbye to the paintings. Pebbles to the Sea. It's a gray in La Grève today. The colors have fallen asleep. Papa is at the marina, and Manon is in the workshop. It's a good thing we have brushes and paints to keep us busy. Flo and Faye, you stay put, they told us. So we stay on the shore and decorate treasures we find on the beach. We leave a little bit of color all around us. Flo shows me two pebbles that sparkle, like our eyes full of mischief. Two, that's our lucky number. Mammon thinks it's a happy number, even if parents don't always make a good pair. All of a sudden, we hear a noise coming from above La Grève. A dot makes an arc across the sky. It's Henry Tribucket, I shout. We love the funny giant slingshot that Henry built. Papa showed it to us. Flo leaps to her feet. Let's go see. Are you coming, Fee? Maybe Papa would like to come with us. Did Mammon hear it too? He's the cat. I have an idea. I gather up our painted pebbles. We'll drop colors along the way, so Mammon and Papa can find us. Flo places a turquoise pebble at our feet. The dock jiggles beneath our boots. But there's no sign of Papa in the marina, even though he is always here, busy repairing the boats. Where can he be? This is the best place for skipping stones across the water. I leave a yellow pebble behind. At the turnoff to the cafe, my stomach starts to growl. Notes from a piano make us feel like dancing. The music stops. Jean-Marc leans over on his bench. What brings you to this way? We tell him about leaving colors on the shore and about Henry's giant slingshot. Jean-Marc smiles. That's Henry. He's been building things ever since he was little. My sister and I look at each other. Henry used to be little. Yes, we grew up right here in La Gravel. It's the perfect playground for a happy life. But if you're going to climb all the way up to the trick bucket, you're going to need some energy. At the counter, a special pulley lifts the lid off a gigantic cake. Flo claps her hands. Jacques Jean-Marc gets up and leaves. Through the window, we can see him going down the road, a pot of paint and a brush in his hand. We leave a green pebble behind, but just a few crumbs on our plate. As we leave the cafe, another dot sails across the sky. Henry is waiting. A ribbon of color trails behind us. The path stretches out ahead. I tug on Flo's sleeve. Francine is waving to us from the front of her shop. We rest for a while at her place. It's nice to be surrounded by the same houses that are in her paintings. You can see Mammon's house and Papa's a little further on. Francine makes us ice cream cones. My father opened this shop in La Grave a long time ago. I used to help my mother make ice cream for the kids. It's funny to imagine Francine having a mother and father. La Grave weaves people into one big family, she says. Even in the winter, everyone here stays tightly woven together. Suddenly, Francine gets up. Time for me to go. She gets out a pot of paint and a brush, and we watch her walk down our winding path. Flo places a white pebble on the ground. Up above La Grave, Henry lifts us onto the Tribeckett ladder. It's a funny contraption. He points to the target out in the bay. A battleship to sink, an enemy castle to attack. Deep down, Henry will always be a little kid ready to play. From way up here, we can see El de Antra on having Havat Arbert side. The beach stretches out like it's trying to reach the other shore. It looks like a hook of sand in the sea. Marmon and Papa took us out there once. Henry knows all about the history of these islands. Long ago, Île d'Entre was linked to Havre Arbot by an ice bridge during the winter. Flo is surprised. The two islands separated? Just like Papa and Mammon? Henry frowns. The ice may have melted, but that didn't stop them from being joined together. At low tide, you can often see the sand bridge beneath the water. The bridge between the two islands can never be broken, the same way you two will always link your mother and father. Time has gone by, and here comes Mammon and Papa. Their hands are filled with pebbles of many colors. "We found you," they say. Flo looks at me. I squeeze her hand tight. Henry climbs off the trabucket, and we jump down into his arms, one at a time. Then he leaves, with a tiny smile on his face and a small pot and brush in his hand. Where could they all be going? There's a surprise waiting for us down on the shore. Turquoise, like the workshop. All our friends are here, but the most beautiful thing of all is the small house they have just finished painting. Turquoise, like the workshop, green, like the cafe, white, like Francine's shop, yellow, like the marina. All the colors of the grave have come together. This is what Mammon and Papa have been up to, a little playhouse of many colors right beside the water. I open the door. I find sketchbooks for drawing, seashells to study. I know we'll be just fine here. From the window of the little house, I see Papa and Marnin looking up at us, smiling. Flo and I keep an eye on each other. For Mammon and Papa, we are more than just a lucky number. We are the bridge that connects their islands. We are the path in the sand that is stronger than the tides themselves. Dirt cheap. What are you looking at, Birdie? Wow, the XR1000 Super Extreme Soccer Ball. Just $24.95. It's so beautiful. I want it. I need it. Well, soccer balls cost money. How much you got? None. If only money did actually grow on trees, or anywhere for that matter, maybe you could sell some of your stuff. No one knows a good deal when they see it nowadays. He's at a yard sale. There must be something I can sell, something I have and people need. Dirt for sale, dirt for sale, high quality, fresh morning dirt for sale, $25 dirt bag. That's a hefty price for a bag of dirt. Is that how much you think it's worth? How should I know what it's worth? I'm just trying to buy a soccer ball. You can't expect to make all the money at once. Maybe you should rethink the price. Dirt cheap, and he's crossing out cheap. Hold up, how cheap? 25 cents. Dirt cheap, cheap dirt. Okay, I have 5 nickels. Oh, well, thanks anyway, mister. Psst, Birdie, that is 25 cents. There's actually lots of ways to make 25 cents. Well, hot dog, my first sale. Dirt cheap, cheap dirt. Birdie, you're really onto something here. Dirt for sale. Come get the freshest, dirtiest dirt anywhere around. And there's a crowd of people. And those are just a few of the ways to do it. 5 pennies, 4 nickels, 3 nickels, 10 pennies, 2 dimes, 1 nickel, 1/4, 25 pennies, 1 dime, 15 pennies, 1 dime, 3 nickels. Thanks. What a price. Such a terrific deal. My lawn will look amazing. I might have to come back later for more. How much did you make, Birdie? Well, looks like a lot. Okay, let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You did it. You can buy the soccer ball of your dreams. All this is the same as $24.95. It sure is. You can even have a few extra coins to spare. And there he goes. He's dragging his bag of coins. So this is it, huh? Looks like a great soccer ball. the XR1000 Super Extreme right. That will be $24.95. Here you are, my good man, every quarter, dime, nickel, and penny. I used to love playing soccer in my yard. Have fun, kid. Yard? Uh-oh. And now when he gets home, guess what? He has no yard because he dug up all the dirt in his yard. Well, now what? Wait. Could this buy some dirt? Sorry, kid. This isn't enough. We'll never sell it so cheap. Oh, and there he is. He's standing in his yard in a giant hole, holding his soccer ball, looking across the street at somebody digging in their yard. Oh, hold on. I know what I can do. Use Birdie's dirt? Try Birdie's lawn care. Free estimate, mowing, trimming, planting, seeding. Interesting. Lucky for me, there's plenty of work. And now he's like pulling, he's planting, he's got the wheelbarrow, he's throwing grass seeds on the ground. Courageous Lucy, the girl who liked to worry. Lucy worried about everything. Lucy worried about normal things, but often she worried about things that other people didn't even know to worry about. Lucy worried that one day her shadow might turn into a giant black hole and swallow her up, or that she might accidentally run into the end of a rainbow. Lucy worried that she might be the first one to discover Bigfoot on the same day he stubbed his toe, or that she might meet the Queen of England on the way to school, but forget her name. In short, Lucy worried about everything, and she worried a lot. Lucy didn't like going first because she didn't want to make a mistake, but she didn't like going last because she was worried she would miss out, and all the kids are getting ready to jump into the pool. Lucy knew lots of things. Lucy knew why stars twinkle. She knew why water appears blue. She knew the capital of Brazil and why humans have 270 bones when they were born, but only 206 as adults. But Lucy was too worried to tell anyone what she knew. When Mrs. Hunt put up a poster for the school musical, the class was excited. Lucy wasn't. She worried that there might be too many people in the audience, or they could get stuck in the hall and the stage might collapse. When Mrs. Hunt started auditions, Charlie sang a song about rainbows and Henry sang a song about chocolate cake. Georgia did a dance for her audition, and Andrew had a full pirate costume. But Lucy just worried that, because everyone else was so good, there wouldn't be anything left for her. When Mrs. Hunt asked for help, Eva brought in costume designs, and Ryan found an old black shirt so he could help backstage. Max brought in his recorder, and Jordan's dad made a giant box to stand on. But Lucy didn't know how she could help, even though she really wanted to. Mrs. Hunt, I would like to be in the musical, Lucy said, after finding some bravery she didn't know she had. Can you sing, Lucy? Mrs. Hunt asked with a kind smile, but Lucy shook her head. Can you be courageous? Mrs. Hunt said. Lucy thought for a moment, and although she wasn't sure she could, she thought she might. So she nodded, and Mrs. Hunt handed Lucy a script. It was for the part of the tree. The tree didn't have any lines, but Mrs. Hunt told her it was a very important part, as she would be on stage the entire time, and in the woodcutter scene, Lucy had to fall over. Lucy practiced swaying in the imaginary wind while Charlie sang songs about new beginnings. Lucy practiced dropping her leaves when Andrew sang about dragons and castles. When everyone practiced their bows, Lucy practiced falling over. When the big night came, Lucy stood up on the stage, and although her knees were knocking and her tummy was tied up in knots, she was the best tree anyone could ever remember. Everyone said it was the greatest performance the school had ever done. Lucy still worries that there might be an earthquake that causes the entire school to vanish, or aliens could choose her to travel to distant planets without her parents. But even though Lucy still worries, she also knows that sometimes you can be courageous too. Okay, I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with Secret Pizza Party. Poor raccoon. All he wants in life is some pizza. If only he knew how to ask politely. And there he is. There's a man chasing him away with a broom standing next to a garbage can. Ah, pizza. So beautiful. You could hang it on the wall of a museum. So convenient. You could eat it in the bathtub. Of course, the best part about pizza is the gooey cheesiness, salty pepperoniness, sweet, sweet tomatoness, and crispy, crispity crunch. Yum. Sorry, raccoon, I didn't mean to rub it in. Hey, cheer up. I just had a great idea. Let's throw a pizza party at your house tonight. Shh, don't tell anyone. This will be a secret pizza party. I know what you're thinking. Why would we keep such a delicious, delicious party a secret? Okay, sure, it's so folks don't show up to bonk you with brooms. But that's not the only reason. When you make something secret, you make it special. Regular handshake? Ah, boring. Secret handshake? Booyah! Regular staircase? Tiring. Secret staircase? Terrific. Regular pizza party? Get that raccoon off the table. Secret pizza party? Get that raccoon another slice of pizza. He's the guest of honor. Hot diggity dog, our pizza party is going to be so much fun. Call the pizza man and tell him to bring over his absolute finest pizza pie. Hang on a minute. You don't want the delivery guy to know where you live? He might recognize you from the posters and chase you off with a broom. Think, raccoon, think. Oh, there he is. Now he's all dressed up. And he's wearing stilts and glasses. Okay, now play it cool. You're just an honest pizza-buying citizen who left his wallet in the car. The pizza man thinks you'll be right back. Let's go! I've planned the perfect getaway route. Around the broom factory, over the broom enthusiast club, past the raccoon-sniffing broom bots. Wait a second. Raccoon-sniffing broom bots? Uh-oh. There he is. All the brooms are coming toward him now. Run, raccoon. Run like the wind. Whew, we made it. Let's barricade the doors and pop open that pizza box. Secret pizza party. Oops, I said that kind of loud. Sorry, pizza smell gives me the happy screams. Try not to crunch too loud. Definitely no high-fiving or music or dancing. In fact, we'd better turn off the lights and whisper just to be safe. Secret pizza party. What's the matter? Sweet, sassy, molassy, look at all that pizza. Clearly, these people are much better at throwing parties than they are at keeping secrets. Uh-oh, all these people are there. Are you thinking what I'm thinking? Okay, you're in. Just play it cool. No one suspects a thing, and everyone's enjoying their pizzas. Uh-oh, and there he is. He's lying now, the raccoon, in the middle of the pizzas, shoving one piece in the middle of his mouth. And there he takes off with all these slices, and he's yelling, "Secret pizza party!" And this is just a reminder, my name is Andy Bomick, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to begin a brand new novel that happened to be the 1958 Newbery Award-winning book, which is the award given for the best children's book, okay, in 1958, titled The Family Under the Bridge. Armand, an old man living on the streets of Paris, is happy with his carefree existence, begging and doing odd jobs to keep himself warm and fed. With a life of simple pleasures, what more could he need? Then one day, just before Christmas, Armand returns to his favorite spot beneath the bridge to find three cold and hungry children. Although he has no interest in children, Armand soon finds himself caring for the small family. It does not take Armand very long to realize that he must do whatever it takes to find them a real home. Chapter 1. Once there was an old hobo named Armand who wouldn't have lived anywhere but in Paris. So that is where he lived. Everything that he owned could be pushed around in an old baby buggy without any hood. So he had no worries about rents or burglars. All the ragged clothing he owned was on his back. So he didn't need to bother with trunks or dry cleaners. It was easy for him to move from one hidey hole to another. So that is what he was doing one late morning in December. It was a cold day with a gray sky hanging on the very chimney pots of Paris. But Armand did not mind because he had a tricky feeling that something new and exciting was going to happen to him today. He hummed a gay tune to himself as he pushed his buggy through the flower market at the side of Notre Dame Cathedral. The flowers reminded him that someday it would be spring, even though it wasn't bad winter yet. There were pots of fragile hyacinths and tulips crowded together on planks in front of the stalls. There were pink carnations and oleanders in great tin pails. Most of all, there were bouquets of red beaded holly, clumps of white pearled mistletoe, and little green fir trees because it would soon be Christmas. Armand's keen eye caught sight of a pile of broken branches and wilted flowers swept away from one stall. Annabelle was the name written over the stall, and Armand touched his black beret to the stocky woman whose blue work apron hung below her woolly coat. "By your leave and ingratitude for your generosity, madam," he said to the woman who was surely Annabelle. He piled the broken branches on top of his belongings in the baby buggy. Then he fastidiously picked a sprig of dry holly from the litter and pulled it through his torn buttonhole. He wanted to look his best for whatever gay adventure was waiting for him this day. The woman, who must have been Annabelle, only frowned at Armand as he trundled his buggy toward the Rue des Courses. Past the ancient buildings, he shuffled. His buggy headed for the far branch of the Seine River. But as he entered the square in front of Notre Dame, A hand grasped his arm from behind. "Your fortune, monsieur," wheeled a musical voice. "You will meet with adventure today." Armand let go of the handle of the buggy and whirled around to face a gypsy woman in a short fur coat and full flowered skirt. He gave her a gape-toothed smile. "You, Morelli," he greeted her. "Your people are back in Paris for the winter?" The gypsy woman's dark face beamed under the blue scarf. "Doesn't one always spend the winters in Paris?" she asked, as if she were a woman of fashion. "But have you taken to the streets so early?" Armand shrugged his shoulders under the long overcoat that almost reached to his ankles. "It's back under the bridge for me," he answered. "I've had enough." The crowded corners and tight alleys in the Place Maubert. "And I'm tired of sorting rags for that junk dealer. I'm ready for that adventure you're promising me." Morelli could understand. "That courtyard we rent seems like a cage after the freedom of the long winding roads," she thought. "But the men have found plenty of work for the winter. A city with as many restaurants as Paris has more than enough pots and pans to be mended. Of course, the children can talk of nothing but the fields and woods of spring." "I can't abide children," grumbled Armand. "Starlings they are, witless, teetering, little pests." Morelli shook her finger at him. "You think you don't like children," she said. "But it is only that you are afraid of them. You are afraid the sly little things will steal your heart if they find out you have one." Armand grunted and took the handle of the buggy again. Morelli waved him away. Swain, on bare feet, squeezed into tarnished silver sandals. "If you change your mind about the bridge, you can come to live with us," she invited. "We're beyond the halls, where they're tearing down the buildings near the old Court of Miracles." Armand tramped under the black, leafless trees and around the cathedral by the riverside without even giving it a glance. In the green park behind the flying buttresses, some street urchins were loitering. Two of them played a dueling while a third, smaller one, watched, munching a red apple. The swordsmen, holding out imaginary swords, circled each other. Closer and closer came the clenched fist. Then the boys forgot their imaginary swords and began punching each other. They stopped their play as Armand went by. "Look at the funny old tramp," one cried to his playmates. Armand looked around because he wanted to see the funny old tramp too. It must be that droll Louis, with his tall black hat and baggy pants. Then he realized that he was the funny old tramp. "Keep a civil tongue in your head. Staring," he ordered. He fingered the holly in his lapel. "If you don't, I'll tell my friend Father Christmas about your rude manners. Then you'll get nothing but a bunch of sticks like these on my buggy." The boys looked at him with awe. Father Christmas is the Santa Claus of France. He rides down from the north on his little gray donkey and leaves presents for good children. The small boy held out his half-eaten apple. "Are you hungry, monsieur?" he asked. "Would you like the rest of this apple?" But the biggest boy mockingly punched the air with his fist. "Poof!" he scoffed. "There's no Father Christmas. He's just make-believe." "If you doubt my word," said Armand with dignity, "just take a look in the Louvre store. You'll find him on the mezzanine floor." He grinned like one of the roguish gargoyles on the cathedral. There really was a Father Christmas, and it was his friend Camille, who felt the urge to work when the weather turned cold. I believe you, Monsieur, said the boy with the apple. I saw Father Christmas outside the store yesterday. He was eating hot chestnuts on the street. Armand hunched his shoulders and quickly walked toward the bridge. Morelli was right. These starlings would steal your heart if you didn't keep it well hidden. And he wanted nothing to do with the children. They meant homes and responsibility and regular work. All the things he had turned his back on so long ago. And he was looking for adventure. Down a few blocks was the bridge under which he lived when the weather wasn't too raw, and plenty of company he had during the summer with all the homeless of Paris, staking their claims to this space or that. But first, I must have dinner, he told himself, looking up at the restaurant across the street. He licked his thumb and held it up. The wind is just right, he decided. So he parked his buggy beside the low wall and settled himself in the breeze that came from the restaurant. He pulled all the kitchen smells deep into his lungs. Ah, steak broiled over charcoal, he gloated. And the sauce is just right. But they scorched the potatoes. For 2 hours, Amon sat on the curb, enjoying the food smells, because that is the length of time a Frenchman allows himself for lunch in the middle of the day. Then he daintily wiped his whiskered lips with his cuff and rose to his knobby shoes. And just keep the change, waiter, he said generously, although there wasn't a white uniformed waiter in sight. You'll need it for Christmas. He started down the steps that dropped from the street to the quay besides the Seine. He bounced the back wheels of the buggy down each step. I am really quite stuffed, he told himself, but I wish I had taken that apple. It would have been the right dessert after such a rich sauce. Down the quay, he pushed the buggy toward the bridge tunnel that ran along the shore. On the cobbled quay, a man was washing his car with the free Seine water. A woman in a fur coat was airing her black poodle. A long barge, sleek as a black seal, slid through the river. It was like coming home after a long absence, thought Armand, and anything exciting could happen under a Paris bridge. As he neared the tunnel, his eyes widened with surprise and anger. A gray canvas was propped over the niche that had always been his own, and a market push cart was parked by the pillar. He raced his buggy across the cobblestones toward the arch. When he arrived there, he reached up and angrily tore down the canvas with one swoop of his arm. Then he jumped back in surprise and horror. Ooh la la, he cried, startlings, a nest full of them. Because three startled children, snuggled into a worn quilt, looked up at him with eyes as surprised as his own. The little girl and a boy cowered deeper into the quilt. But the older girl quickly jumped to her feet. She had direct blue eyes, and they matched her determined chin and snubbed nose and bright red hair. You can't take us away, she cried, clenching her fist. We're going to stay together because we're a family, and families have to stick together. That's what Mama says. Chapter 2. As Armand glared at the children, a shaggy dog that should have been white came bounding across the quay. It protectively jumped between the tramp and the children, barking fiercely at Armand. The hobo quickly maneuvered his buggy between himself and the dog. If that beast bites me, he cried, I'll sue you for 10,000 francs. The girl called the dog to her. Here, Jojo. Come, Jojo. He won't take us away. He's only an old tramp. The dog stopped barking and sniffed at the wheels of Armand's baby buggy. The man was insulted. I'll have you know that I'm not just any old tramp, he said. And he wasn't. I'm not friendless. and I could be a working man right now if I wanted. But where are your parents? And who are you hiding from? The police? He studied the children closely. Redheads they were, all of them, and their clothes had the mismatched, ill-fitting look of poverty. The older girl's eyes burned a deep blue. Our landlady put us out because we don't have enough money to pay for the room since Papa died, she explained. So Mama brought us here because we haven't any home now. And she told us to hide behind the canvas so nobody could see us. Or they'd take us away from her and put us in a home for poor children. But we're a family, so we want to stay together. I'm Susie, and they're Paul and Evelyn. The boy swaggered a little. If I was bigger, I'd find a new place for us to live, he boasted. It looks to me like you've already found a new place, said Armand. And it's my old place. You've put me out of my home, just like that landlady did to you. Susie was apologetic. She moved the pushcart over and measured Armand with one eye closed. Then she carefully drew a long rectangle on the concrete with a piece of soft coal. That's your room, she said. You can live with us. On second thought, she scrawled a small checkered square at the foot of the rectangle. There's a window, she said gravely, so you can look out and see the river. Armand grumbled to himself and pulled his coat tighter across his chest, as if to hide his heart. Oh, this starling was a dangerous one. He'd better move on. Paris was full of bridges, the way the Seine meandered through it. No trouble finding another one. But as he started away, the girl ran over and clutched him by his torn sleeve. Please stay, she begged. We'll pretend you're our grandfather. Armand snorted. Little one, he said. Next to a millionaire, a grandfather is the last thing I hope to be. But even as he grumbled, he began unpacking his belongings. He stacked the branches and twigs and made a pile of the dead leaves he had gathered. He pulled out a dirty canvas and a rusty iron hook. He set a blackened can with a handle near the leaves. He sorted some bent spoons and knives. Last of all, he pulled out an old shoe with a hole in the sole. Might come across its mate one of these days, he explained to the children, and it fits me just right. The children wanted to help him. Oh, these starlings were clever. They knew how to get around an old man. Lucky he wasn't their grandfather. But he laid his canvas over the rectangle Susie had made for him. He started a fire with the branches and dead leaves. Then he hung a big can over the fire. Into it, he dropped scraps of food he unwrapped from pieces of newspaper. Well, in the good old days of Paris, he told the children, they used to ring bells in the marketplace at the close of day so the tramps would know they were welcome to gather up the leftovers. But no more. Nowadays, we have to look after ourselves. They watched him eating his food. Even the dog that should have been white watched each morsel that went into his mouth and drooled on the concrete. Armand wriggled uneasily. What's the matter? He asked gruffly. Haven't you ever seen anybody eat before? They said nothing in reply, but four pairs of eyes followed each move of his tin spoon. I suppose you're hungry, he growled. Starlings always have to be eating. Get your tinware. Susie pulled some stained, cracked bowls and twisted spoons from the pushcart. Armand carefully divided the food, even counting in the dog. It was dark by the time the children's mother joined them. The lights of Paris were floating in the river, but the only light in the tunnel flickered from a tiny fire Armand had made. He could not see the woman's face well, but he felt the edge of her tongue. What are you doing here? She demanded of the hobo. Armand was angered. And I might ask you the same, madam, he retorted. You have taken my piece of the bridge. The bridge don't belong to anybody, said the woman. They're the only free shelter in Paris. Susie tried to make peace. He's a nice, friendly old tramp, Mama, she explained, and he's going to live with us. I'm not a friendly old tramp, said Armand indignantly. I'm a mean, cranky old tramp, and I hate children and dogs and women. Then, if you hate us, said Paul, why did you give us some of your food? Because I'm a stupid old tramp, replied Armand. Because I'm a stupid, soft-hearted old tramp. Ooh la la, there it was. He had let slip that he really had a heart. Now this homeless family would surely be after that too. The mother was displeased to hear that the children had accepted the hobo's food. We are not beggars, she reminded them. I have a steady job at the laundry, and that is more than he can say. She went to work warming a pan of soup and breaking a long loaf of bread that she had brought with her. Armand sat in the rectangle marked by Susie and thought that this woman's trouble was pride, and that pride and life under the bridge weren't going to work out well together. By the dying light of the fire, the woman went back and forth to her pushcart, pulling out moth-eaten blankets and making bed places on the concrete. Just overhead, the automobiles roared, lights garland the bridge, and people walked along the higher quay, laughed lightly. But it could have been a million miles away from the little group under the bridge. You ought to put the starlings in some charity home until you find a place of your own, madam, suggested Armand, after the children had dropped off to sleep. This life is not for them. Now, you wouldn't want them to end up like me, would you? Families should stick together through the lean times as well as the fat, replied the woman. And I have hopes. I'm going to see my sister-in-law soon. She may know of a place for us out in Clinchy. Armand stretched out on his canvas without bothering about any covering. He was used to the cold. He never felt it anymore. But he was sure these children would feel it. As he lay on the hard concrete, an uneasy thought worried him, like a mouse gnawing at his shoestring. Now that he had befriended these starlings, his life would never again be completely his own. When gray morning seeped into the blackness under the bridge, Armand woke to find the woman gone and the three children feeding some stale bread to Jojo. Are you still here? Asked Armand. Don't you go to school or something today? Susie shook her red head. We can't go to school again until we find a place to live. Mama says the teachers might begin asking us questions. Then the people would take us away from her and put us in a home. Your mama wants you around more than I do, said Armand. Children should go to school. Where would I be today if I hadn't gone to school when I was a starling? Oh, I like school, said Susie, with her blue eyes glowing. I like to read and write. I want to be a teacher when I get big. See, a man on a barge threw this piece of coal at me, and I use it for a pencil. I hope we'll soon be able to go back to school again. Then that's where we're different, confessed Armand. I never did like school, but you surely must go someplace during the day. Your mama can't expect me to be a nursemaid. I've got places to go. Oh, may we go with you? Begged Susie. Evelyn is a real good little walker. She won't get tired. No, cried Armand in alarm. You can't go with me. And that's the whole cheese of it. Please take us, old tramp, implored Paul. It's so cold hiding down here with nothing to do. That's not polite, Paul, warned Susie. Now he won't take us with him unless you apologize. But what can I call him? Asked Paul. I don't know his name. What is your name, monsieur? Asked Susie. Armand, replied the hobo. But your last name asked Paul. Ours is Calchete. Armand shrugged his shoulders. I've forgotten, he admitted. I think it used to be Poli or Pugi, something like that. Just call me Armand. All right, Monsieur Armand, said Paul. I apologize for calling you an old tramp. Now, will you take us with you? Of course he will, said Susie quickly. He really has a good heart, even if he looks so bad. And may Jojo go too? Armand clutched at the part of his coat covering his heart. Oh, these startlings were after it, all right. Ooh la la, he exclaimed. And where would I be seen with three children and a dog? He demanded. What friend would want me dropping in with such a company? Then a sly look crossed his weather-beaten face. Perhaps it wouldn't be a bad idea to take these appealing fledglings out on the street with him. No, indeed. He had a splendid idea. Of course, it wasn't just the thing of which that proud mother would approve. How would you like to go uptown and meet my friend Father Christmas? He asked the children. They were so astonished that they couldn't speak for a few seconds. Susie's eyes grew bluer and bluer with wonder. Father Christmas, she finally exclaimed in a hushed voice. The Father Christmas who brings presents at Christmas time? Paul could hardly believe it. Do you know Father Christmas? He asked. And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with The Family Under the Bridge. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.